in my town were sure I was crazy when I decided to start walking to Europe. The best thing in life is to know oneself. I slept in ditches near the road in thunderstorms. I was involved in accidents. I've seen friends die next to me. But my concentration has never flagged. It has been an adventure that so far has lasted 20 years. But it will keep going on for the rest of my life. Through these experiences, I have come to see that the world is not worth much. The only thing that counts for me now, first and last, is God. The main thing is that we were born to praise the Lord. If I am to live 20 more years, I will try to live enjoying each moment, instead of killing myself to get more. I set out on this journey like a baby bird hatching from its egg. Ever since, I've been walking in freedom.
Perhaps the ultimate challenge is living a meaningful life. Here you'll learn how using flow can help to make this task a bit easier.
Enjoying the separate elements of life, like work, play, relationships, and solitude, will go a long way towards making your life more full and happy. But most people need to find a unifying theme that relates the various facets of experience into a meaningful whole. Religions and value systems often perform this function. One may think of these systems of belief as the rules of an all-encompassing game, the game of life. We should talk now about how these life themes are created, these themes that give purpose and meaning to the whole of existence, and how they can bring flow into a person's entire existence. First of all, to have a life theme means that one has a purpose, has an overarching goal that will lead and order and create priorities in all of our actions. In addition to this purpose, we need resolve. We need to have the habits, the discipline that will allow us to move day by day, moment by moment towards the realization of these goals. When we have a purpose and we have developed the skills to pursue them, then the next task is to make sure that all of the actions that we do during our life are not going to conflict with these goals that we have established. So the third step in achieving a life that is harmonious and unified is to connect everything we do and to learn to make sure that the various things we do during life are not going to conflict with the overarching goals that we have established. When these three elements are in place, namely an overarching goal, a set of skills or habits to achieve them, and when we have established a connection between every action we do and these purposes, then we probably have developed a life theme. And once we have a life theme, a scenario, a script that gives a purpose to what we do, then we are set for experiencing everything we do in life as meaningful and enjoyable.
The two kinds of life themes.
Let me talk more in detail about what it means to have a life theme. There are basically two kinds of life themes. One of them is what we could call a presented life theme. This is the script or scenario for our life that we essentially inherit from the culture in which we live. We just know, for instance, in our culture that one should desire to have a good job, a nice family, at least two new cars in the garage, having a home in a good neighborhood. These elements of a life theme, that is, these props of a life, are presented because we really don't make any decision in having them. We don't have to choose them. They are present in the warp and woof of our culture. They are part of the script that we are presented with as we are born in this culture. Now, trying to achieve these goals gives us a theme for our life, but a theme which is okay only as long as everything else goes well, as long as we have no illness, no economic downturn, no problems in the family. But once the culture fails to provide the support that we are expecting and we think we are entitled to, then this kind of presented life theme begins to have less and less of a meaning, and people begin to get disoriented. They feel in the middle of their lives, as they struggled for 30, 35, 40 years to achieve these goals, there's very often a sense of, well, is this all there is to it? Is there anything more in life that I should be achieving? These goals do not fulfill the person's unique potentialities. They are kind of like a generic script, a generic set of goals, a generic theme, which can be satisfying, but generally turns out to leave a person dissatisfied and unfulfilled in the middle of one's life. On the other hand, there are other types of life themes. These are the ones I would call discovered life themes. These themes evolve as a person learns to find a goal that makes sense given his or her unique temperament and unique situation. In other words, these are goals that one develops as one pays attention to what feels good, what kind of skills one has. We all are born with different skills. I mean, some of us are much more in tune with sounds, so we can discriminate, differentiate sounds better than others. We have a better ear. We have a more tuneful voice. A person like that, if he or she is paying attention to this difference, that this gift that he or she was given, can develop a life theme which is much more unique and more responsive to what is the gift that this person had that others don't have. Other individuals are born with greater sensitivity to light, to color, and they may go in the direction of becoming visual artists or designers or architects or decorators. Some of us are born with a sensitivity to people or with a greater moral sense. Some children have a sense of what's fair and unfair, and they're concerned about it. We don't know why. It's probably a neurological difference that makes them sensitive to fairness and unfairness. Now, out of that, you can develop a life theme that is more in tune with who you are, with the particular gifts that you were given to. At the same time, discovered life theme is in tune with the environment, with the event that are happening, with the kind of people, the kind of situations that you have. Let me give a few examples. One person that is part of the study I have been doing for the past 30 years is a person I will call Alex, who was born to a very poor family of immigrants at the beginning of this century. His parents were illiterate, they didn't know anything about the culture in which they were living, except that they were very grateful to be able to be in America instead of Russia, where they had been oppressed. And so they looked with great admiration and great trust to this country that promised equality and well-being to immigrants. Well, Alex was 7 years old. When he drove a bicycle down the street, this bicycle was given to him by his parents, and it represented years of saving, scraping and saving from food and clothes so that Alex could have a bicycle. And he was very proud and very happy riding it down the street when suddenly he was struck by a car that had jumped a traffic sign and had hit him. And he fell down, he was badly bruised, and the bike was completely destroyed. Now, out of the car stepped a doctor who owned the car, and this doctor convinced Alex and later his family that they should not report the accident because it would be too time-consuming and bureaucratic, whereas the doctor himself would take care of Alex and would bring him into a hospital and make sure that everything was taken care of and that then he would buy him a new bike. So the parents, who were very impressed and intimidated by a professional, a doctor, while they were poor illiterates, agreed to this arrangement. And Alex was taken to the hospital, but the doctor actually did not treat him for free, and the hospital presented a large bill to Alex's parents. Neither did this doctor buy a new bike to Alex. So he ended up coming out of the hospital poorer than he went in, and the family was very depressed and disillusioned. Now, at this point, Alex could have decided that he was unlucky, that everybody else were mean, and that life was a set of confrontations where you sometimes you lose, sometimes you win. But instead of that, what Alex did was, over the years, to begin thinking about what happened to him and realized that the event, this unfortunate event that he experienced, was part of a much larger picture. It was part of a situation in which ignorant people, illiterate people who did not have the opportunity to be educated, were being exploited, whether purposefully or not, but inevitably they were being exploited by a system where people with greater resources, greater education could operate without compunction, without being afraid of being called to task by those who had no education to know better, to defend their interest. So, to make a long story short, Alex ended up becoming a lawyer, becoming a professor of law, and he ended up as a member of President Truman's cabinet, and he was responsible for enacting a whole set of legislations that would defend the rights of minorities, the rights of poor people. And in doing so, he marshaled all his energies, all his attention, under the umbrella of this single purpose of helping those who could not help themselves. And his life team became essentially a channel where all his energies, all his goals were subordinated to the wider social goal of helping other people. A somewhat similar example is that of Stephen, who was a young boy when his mother died of cancer. And the young boy felt increasing hatred for these mysterious forces that were robbing the health of his mother and making her feel pain. And eventually his mother was buried. Stephen remembers that as a young boy of 8, he stood by the grave and he swore to himself that eventually he would defeat this illness that had caused his mother's suffering and death. Very early, Stephen began to work as a medical researcher, as a chemist first, and then a medical researcher, and he has become now one of the most famous oncologists or cancer researchers in this country. These examples of Alex and Stephen show how very often a discovered life team is a result of a tragedy or a hardship. And we have talked about this before, that very often it is hardships, it is tragedies that create the reason for us to get out of the normal routine of the presented goals of having a good job, nice family, two cars, etc. It gives us a reason for getting dissatisfied with the ordinary aspirations, the ordinary goals that we share with other members of society. And it is these external pressures, tragedies, that force us to react and force us to ask ourselves, now, what is it that I need to do in this world? What is it that I have to accomplish? And that external impetus, that external force, often is enough to provide a lifelong goal, a set of priorities under which everything else will fall and will give you a set of challenges that it takes a whole life to learn to react to. Now, both Alex and Stephen, even though they suffered these early tragedies and problems, were able to have an entire life which provided flow to them because they knew what they had to do moment by moment, as well as over the whole arch of their lives. They were purposefully involved with a set of challenges that they felt were meaningful and were worth investing attention in, investing energy in. So they essentially created, out of their early problems, an overarching system of actions, almost like a global game that gave them a purpose, a reason to work, and a set of challenges that they could match.
How they did it.
Where do the solution to these discovered life themes come from? How did Stephen and Alex realize what they could do, given the fact that they were presented, in a sense, with the problem, but then they had to discover a solution to that? Well, in both cases, as in most cases of discovered life themes, the solution was pieced together from examples, from models of people who were inspirational in their lives, and very often from books, reading in books about people who overcome problems, who found solution to the problems, makes you feel that, hey, you know, it's possible. I'm not alone. I'm not the only one with this type of problems. There have been other people confronted by similar or worse problems. They have been able to overcome it, so I will be able to overcome it. Another person who, for instance, used books to recreate himself and to develop a discovered life team is Malcolm X. As a young boy, he was a juvenile delinquent in the ghetto. He ran drugs, he was a pimp, he got into all kinds of scrapes, he was arrested several times, he hurt people, he was hurt personally, but he had a completely entropic existence. That is, everything he did was in conflict with others or with conflict within himself. And it was in jail, actually, that Malcolm X started reading books, and he became aware of ways of creating harmony in life by developing a larger purpose. So that when he was released from jail, he had a team, he had a purpose, he had a priority, which was that of understanding the preachings of Islam and how to apply it to modern day life and how to organize the Afro-American political forces towards the goal. So in his case, the ability to develop a life team came fairly late in life. But it's always possible to use the resources of the culture, the examples, the models, the books, and of course to use the meaning systems that culture has developed. These meaning systems include religion, philosophy, art, all of which try to give us a sense of how to organize life in a harmonious way towards a set of goals that can enrich our lives and give purpose to it so that we can lose ourselves in this skillful activity that's required to achieve these high goals, but which allow us to experience flow along the way. The problem with already packaged meaning systems like religions and philosophies is that it is easy to fall into a presented mode of accepting them. In other words, they can become inauthentic if we don't really put a lot of work into rediscovering the truths that are in these already existing meaning systems. It's easy to embrace a religion out of despair. It is easy to accept a philosophy because it seems fashionable or it seems like a learned thing to do. But if we do that without reflecting and without matching the religious and philosophical techniques or theories to our real nature and to our real situation, then instead of discovering a life theme, we will simply accept another presented life theme. The most ambitious life theme is one that is based on the goal of becoming part of the most powerful energy in the universe. For a religious person, this is God. In fact, in all religions, the highest goal is somehow to find a way of uniting oneself with the force that rules the cosmos, that rules the universe. In our own time, this goal may be expressed as becoming a conscious, leading part in the process of evolution. Becoming a leading part in the process of evolution means to help make the future more harmonious and more enjoyable for oneself and for as many other people as possible. To help to make the planet less polluted, to make it more fruitful, to make it more beautiful, to help along all forms of life as well as humanity and oneself. This goal, if we really believe in it, if it makes sense to us, can give the most ambitious, but most exciting, most exhilarating purpose to everything we do in life.
Developing your discovered life theme.
So how can you develop a discovered life theme if you want to? Well, you should probably by now know what in your life you think is most precious to you. What in your life is most disturbing? Are there any single things that, if you could resolve them, would give you a sense of accomplishment above everything else? Would it be to help a certain person? Would it be to develop some potential that you think you have but you have never developed? Is it that you are worried about the state of the world in the future, either in terms of what's happening to us as a society or what is happening to the globe, to the planet? You should find out what is it in your life that is most precious, that is most important. We find, for instance, when interviewing professionals, businessmen, executives in their 50s who have had a burnout, whose life suddenly lost meaning, if you ask them what do they think that resulted in their present despair or depression, if you ask them what caused their burnout, they will tell you almost unanimously that the most important reason is that they never developed priorities in their lives. They never asked themselves what counted most, what was most important. Or if they asked themselves that, they didn't take themselves seriously. They didn't act on their perception of what mattered the most. Instead, they went along with whatever forces pushed them or pulled them at this point. They responded to other people. They used whatever demands or whatever emergencies arose as an excuse to divert their psychic energy into these immediate responses instead of really following up on what was most precious, most important, most salient in their own life, in their own experience. There is no one theme that will fit all. There is not even one theme that may fit more than one or two persons at a time. You have to decide what you would like to feel at the end of your life that you have accomplished and you will be proud of, that you would feel that it was worth living for. Whatever that is, whether it's accomplishing a certain skill or a certain relationship or a certain well-being or a certain action that will make others feel better or live better, whatever that is, that will give you the reference point, the compass point that would help you to organize your life, to establish priorities, and that could lead you into the future. For some of us, it may be that we indeed have to postpone and compromise for a while. We can't do what we wanted to do. We can't go off into the South Seas and become a marine biologist because we don't have the resources. We have other obligations, responsibilities. But if we have to compromise, if we have to postpone, at least we should keep this leading goal, this priority that we know is the most important thing in our life. We should keep that alive. We should keep it for when the next opportunity arises and then take it. In one hospital in the Netherlands, a colleague of mine, Dr. Martin de Vries, has used our techniques to measure the quality of experience to find out how patients who have been recovered for years and sometimes dozens of years in these mental hospitals, how they can be taken and reintegrated into normal life without creating a burden on the community and enhancing the life of the former patients. One example, for instance, was a woman who had been in the hospital for over 15 years, who was diagnosed as a chronic schizophrenic and who essentially lived a vegetative life in the hospital. She did not do anything interesting. Nobody paid attention to her. She was essentially just like a piece of furniture there. Martin de Vries gave her the pager to evaluate the quality of experience, and after 2 weeks noticed that there were only two times in 2 weeks that this woman approached anything similar to flow, where she felt alert, awake, concentrated, she felt better about herself. And these were times she had been cutting her fingernails. Now, it occurred to the therapist that if this woman was trained as a manicurist, she may have more often this feeling of positive experience. So they trained her. She became so involved in cutting and caring for the fingernails of the people in the hospital that she completely changed from essentially a vegetable into an active person. She didn't talk much, she didn't laugh a lot, but she was focused, she was involved, interested in what she was doing. So after a while she was released in the community, and they had a social worker visiting her every twice a day at first, and then every day, then twice a week. And now this woman, after essentially having been sentenced for a life of complete uselessness in a hospital, is an active participant in the community. She's cutting the nails of people. She has a shingle on her door. We don't know why this is enjoyable to her. We may never find out. But the point is that her life has changed. And many of the lives of people who are now depressed, who are chronically unhappy with their lives, could change if instead of taking the situation as something for granted, something that is there and you can't help, take the control over your life, and maybe with the help of others, if not by yourself, change it around by discovering what is enjoyable, what you like to do in life, and try to develop the habits to pursue those goals in a way that more and more of your life becomes imbued with flow. Having a life theme means to create a personal fate, an overall goal for one's existence. It means that you have an ultimate purpose, and you are free to pursue it regardless of pressures and worries. When you have chosen a goal and decided on a path to reach it, everything you do will have a meaning. Whether you succeed or not, you will know that you are part of evolving complexity. The energy of your consciousness will be blended with the creative striving for order in the whole universe. When the whole of life is transformed into a single flow experience, the dissatisfaction that casts a shadow on so many of our lives will become just a distant memory.
A mountain climber discusses his deep flow experience.
There's no place that more draws the best from human beings than a mountaineering situation. Nobody hassles you to put your mind and body under tremendous stress to get to the top. Your comrades are there. But you all feel the same way anyway. You're all in it together. It's exhilarating to come closer and closer to self-discipline. You make your body go and everything hurts. Then you look back in awe of the self. And what you've done, it just blows your mind. If you win these battles enough, that battle against yourself, at least for a moment, it becomes easier to win the battles in the world. Sometimes I think it's my only survival in the space age. Without that, I wouldn't last a week out here.
As you start learning about flow, you probably have many questions that come to your mind about how to make this optimal experience more a part of your life. As I travel around the country, people keep asking questions that I haven't answered in my own work, but which are important for each individual to know so that they can apply the general principles of flow to their own situation. Let us review some of these questions, and hopefully my answers to them will help you answer the doubts that you have or the concerns that you have in your own mind.
Is there an automatic way for people to get into flow?
Of course, if you do have activities that you usually do that provide this experience, then often just focusing on that activity will help. For instance, if you like to play chess, you bring out the board and set up the pieces, and if you have an opponent to play against, or you can play against a problem that you take from a book, you can get involved immediately because the set itself, the pieces will get you to focus in on what you're doing. If you have a routine of exercises, you start doing the exercises, you go through them, and eventually, the more you focus, the more you are aware of what the challenges are, and you're beginning to respond to those challenges with your skills, sooner or later you will get involved and you will enter flow. In other words, it's important to have some ready-made routines, some activities that you like to do, cooking your favorite meal or watching your favorite show or taking a good book or getting to talk to a good friend. Any of these activities, if you have practiced them, if they have become part of your repertoires of activities, will get you into the flow state automatically. If you don't have already prepared routines, then it's much more difficult, and that's why it's good to develop the discipline. But if you find yourself in a new situation where you can't easily move into the flow state, then it's good to have certain mental habits, certain mental disciplines that can get you there even without external props. So if you learn some meditative technique or some simple steps towards self-hypnosis, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as it helps you to focus the mind and avoid the distractions, avoid the bombardment of external stimuli which interferes with flow. Once you have achieved that state, then you can focus on whatever is at hand, either doing your job, driving the car, or watching other people pass by and visualize, daydream in your mind. Any of these can get you into the state once you have prepared yourself to avoid the distractions and you're in a position of focusing.
Can you have flow all the time? Or do you need some time to relax, some time to just vegetate, to read trashy novels, or to just be by yourself without anything to do?
Of course, it's true that we cannot be in flow all the time. We cannot sustain that high level of use of skills, that involvement with challenges all the time. And we shouldn't feel, therefore, ashamed if part of our life is devoted to simply relaxing. The problem becomes when we take relaxation as being the goal of our free time, when that's the only thing that we seek when we are free. Because we find that when people try relaxing, for the first hour maybe it works, but then you become tense again. Even, for instance, if you watch TV for a few hours, the first hour you begin relaxing and then you begin to be tense again. Whereas if you are involved in some activity like gardening, like carpentry, or even reading a book that challenges you, then the relaxation continues even though you are not trying to relax. You are actively involved, but because it is an activity you choose and you are balancing your skills with the challenges, you don't get stressed out by that involvement. In fact, you become more relaxed. So the paradox is that trying to relax too much makes you more tense eventually, whereas an involvement with something that is purposeful, that uses your skills, ends up by relaxing you more. So you need time to just plain relax, but if you misunderstand how relaxation comes about, you may be missing the boat by trying to do too much of it. So it's better to spend the minimum necessary time in pure relaxation and spend the rest in activities that allow you to grow as a person, that make you more complex and make the activity itself more enjoyable.
Can you have too much flow? Can flow become addictive?
Well, it's true that one of the secrets of using flow is, first of all, to find it in activities which are constructive. You can have flow in activities which are destructive. For instance, one of our first studies was a study of juvenile delinquents, of young people who came from good families. These were all teenagers from affluent suburbs. They didn't have to steal, they didn't have to break into cars, to vandalize. They did it because they were bored. They could find nothing more enjoyable in their environment except breaking the law for instance, one of them, he was asked why he broke into a house. He said, well, if you could show me how to do something that was as enjoyable as walking into a house without waking up the owners and stealing their jewelry, then I would do that. I can't think of anything that gives as much enjoyment to me. And it's true that if a person has no skills, then people will find flow wherever they can find it. They will find it in destruction, in violence. And so the real task of those of us who feel responsible for the future, who feel responsible for the next generation, is to make sure that people can have flow experiences in activities which are not destructive but are constructive, that are creative, that can lead to a better future. This is something that the philosopher Plato realized over 25 centuries ago when he said that the task of education, the major goal of education, is to teach young people to find pleasure in the right things. And we present young people with goals that we think are right, but they are not pleasurable. We don't teach them how to get pleasure from the right things. We think that they will learn how to use their mind. They will learn how to become useful citizens, even if it's a boring task. They won't do that. We have to make these things enjoyable. Otherwise, they will find enjoyment in alternatives which are destructive, violent, wasteful. Though flow can even become addictive in an activity which is productive and useful. For instance, I referred often to surgeons as being people who really love their work. However, the danger there is that the job or the profession can be so enjoyable that you spend all of your life devoting yourself to developing the skills so that you can operate in that system of challenges, whether it's surgery or being a lawyer, being a computer expert, salesman, whatever. And nothing else interests you. You lose the ability to recognize opportunities outside your profession or job. At that point, the rest of life becomes very meaningless, very pale, insipid compared to the challenges that you find in your job. And this type of addiction to a single source of flow can be dangerous because at that point you miss possibilities that in the long run may be more important to you. For instance, you may miss the relationship with your other people. You will not have real friends. You may have very barren marriage. Your children may not have the advantage of your attention and the focus of your energies on them. And so you end up becoming essentially something like an idiot savant, a person who has only one little narrow area of expertise, a narrow area of enjoyment, And of course, the danger is that once you exhaust that, when you have to retire or when you can no longer do the job that produced enjoyment, then you're left with nothing. And that addiction is dangerous. So the cure for that, or the way to prevent it, is to be open to as many opportunities as possible, as time and opportunity allows you, and learn to appreciate enough of the various challenges that life surrounds us with, so that if one of them begins to be less rewarding or more difficult to achieve, then you have others to move on.
How can flow make me more successful in my job?
Well, I hate to directly try to answer that question, because for two reasons. First, that success depends also on many things over which we don't have control. It depends on the state of the economy, the state of the particular business or line of work we are involved in. So nobody can promise external success to come from purely psychological processes. Certainly, you can prepare yourself for being successful, you can work on it, but I could not promise that being able to experience flow, having a complex consciousness, will necessarily lead to success in financial or professional lines. However, having said that, it's certainly true that most successful people that I know, recently I have had the good fortune of talking to a great number of them, from successful scientists to artists to business leaders, politicians, all of them have gotten to where they are in large part because they were able to enjoy so much what they were doing. Usually, if you do a job well, but you don't enjoy it, you get up to a certain point, to the point where you feel comfortable, where you are getting a good income, when you get enough respect. Generally, that's where you stop, because doing anything more would not increase the external benefits that you are expecting from your job. To push beyond the status quo, to push beyond the level at which most people stop, you have to also enjoy what you're doing. And that is why so many of the successful people got to where they are, because they were motivated to push beyond the limits of the accepted performance, not because they wanted success. It's because they enjoyed what they were doing. They enjoyed doing scientific research, or they enjoyed the political process. They enjoyed the business, entrepreneurial activities that were involved in their business. And because they enjoyed it, they became successful. However, again, in the long run, the question is not so much whether you are going to be a rich businessman or a powerful politician. The important thing, the bottom line of life, really, is whether you feel good about yourself, whether you feel good about the life you are leading. Because success is ephemeral. It seems important. External success seems important when we don't have it. When we lack the money, we want more of it. If we lack power, we want power. But once you achieve these ends, you're back to square one. You either want more money or more power, or you find out that what you have gotten so far really hasn't made your life any better. So the bottom line, what makes life really worth living, is what you experience along the way. How do you feel about what you do? How do you feel about yourself as you are pursuing a goal that makes sense, that is meaningful within the priorities that you have achieved? If these include success in business, if they include political power, fine. But then the reward is not what you get at the end. The reward is the use of your skills in pursuing financial success or political success as you are moving there. And if that's the attitude you learn to have, then generally what you will find, that lo and behold, you get those outcomes almost as a byproduct. The success you achieve comes to you not because you wanted to get them, but because you did your job so well along the way, because you enjoyed doing it, so the success will be there anyway.
What's the most important element? Or what's the most important component of flow to have?
That's a difficult question to answer, in part because it seems to me that in order to have the fullness of experience, you have to have all of the 8 elements that I described, the setting of goals, the ability to read the feedback, concentration, avoidance of distraction, the feeling of unself-consciousness, control, and finally disappearance of the sense of time. These tend to be synergistic. They work together and reinforce each other. And all of these are, to a certain extent, important. In some activities, one or the other may be missing. In some activities, for instance, time is very much of the essence. So you may be very aware of time in those activities because it's part of the challenge. For instance, if you are a conductor of an orchestra or a surgeon who is doing a very delicate operation, you have to do it within very severe time constraints. So time becomes a challenge, a part of the task that you have to learn to control. So in that case, since the time doesn't pass faster, but you are controlling your performance within time constraints. So that's an example when one of these elements may not be important. But basically, I would say that if you were to give a short summary of what is essential for flow, I would say they are those 3 elements that one has to have in order to develop an autotelic personality. Namely, first, the ability to set goals, to find goals, even in activities that don't seem to have it. For instance, if your dishwasher can't work anymore and you have to wash the dishes by hand, you may set a goal even in that situation of what are you going to wash first, the glasses or the silverware or the plates. Once you decided that, that gives an order to your activities. It makes everything follow and flow in a way that it wouldn't have if you just started randomly to clean the first pieces that come into your hand. So even in a trivial activity like that, you always try to structure it, to give it shape, to give it form by giving it goals, but giving yourself goals within that activity. So that's the first step. The second step is to be aware of what's going on, to be able to pay attention and to be flexible in your attention. This is especially important these days when things happen to change so fast. You can't make sure that the goals you had developed when you were in college or in high school or even as a young adult, whether those goals are realistic anymore. The economy changes, technology changes, the skills you were prepared to use as you prepared yourself for a productive career may be no longer state of the art. In fact, they may no longer be applicable in the marketplace as it is now. So if you pay attention, if you are in sync, in touch with what goes on around you, you can move with the changes to the extent that you want to move. You don't have to be a weather vane and change with every change in fashion. In fact, that would be probably counterindicative for having flow. You have to maintain a kind of internal compass point. You have a life theme, you want to pursue that. But how to get there, the means to realize your goals, may have to change as the situation around you changes. So you won't know what is changing, what you have to do, unless you pay attention, unless you are in touch with your environment. And then, as we said before, the third basic component, having goals, having paid attention, the third one is to find how can you use your skills within the situation as it is, the realistic situation, so as to solve the kind of problems, the challenges that are available to you. That means that you are able to identify the forces that impinge on you, that you can figure out how to retrain yourself if, for instance, your skills are no longer the ones that will get you to your goals given the change in the marketplace. that you understand how you have to vary your tactics in order to preserve the overall strategy. For instance, by making sure that your living conditions, the address that you have, the kind of neighborhood you live in, the job you have, the friends you have, that these continue to support your goals rather than perhaps create obstacles that you didn't realize before.
What differentiates flow from the notion of just keeping busy? As the saying goes, the devil will find work for idle hands.
In some ways, of course, this old wisdom that our grandmothers had, talking about having to always work, was not so completely off. It perhaps was more responsive to how human psychology works than much of the modern contemporary emphasis on how you should fulfill yourself by either meditating or doing your own thing or not being hassled by anything and just being laid back and so forth. It may be more truthful to human psychology because it's true that when you are focused on an activity, we find that most people's consciousness falls in line with an effortless, spontaneous beam of concentrated energy, whereas when that doesn't happen, when you have nothing to do and there's no one around, then that energy is diffused and begins to go in circle and begins to feel as a source of disappointment to the person. However, having said that, it's also clear that simply mindless behavior that one takes refuge in because in order to avoid feeling depressed or feeling bored is not a cure either. In fact, some of the greatest flow experiences are by people who are not doing anything active with their hands or are not involved in any goal and task, but who can use their minds to pursue ideas, to pursue verse, to pursue philosophical reflection or a scientific theory or whatever organized mental activity that will achieve concentration within the mind and under the control of the person's consciousness. So what we are talking about in flow that is different from keeping busy is that in flow, you are the master of your own consciousness. You are the master of your psychic energy. You choose the goals. You recognize the challenges and you choose which challenges to recognize and then find out whether responding to those challenges really results in an enjoyable activity. Usually it does. If it does not, then for heaven's sake, don't persevere in it just because it is a routine that keeps your mind away from other worse things. Switch goals, switch challenges, switch skills until what you're doing begins to resonate in your consciousness as something that is enjoyable. You will recognize it. You will know when you're in flow. If you're not, you have tried the wrong thing. But it's only through trial and error that we learn which goals are the most appropriate to us. There are so many things you can try, from learning the various cuisines of the world to all the music that has been written in the world to all the sports, all the skills that people have learned. In there, I'm sure you will find one which once you start acting and you say, yeah, this is for me. This is what I enjoy doing. This is my calling. The great gift of flow is that if you have learned to achieve this state, you will have outcomes that match the best that we can dream of having in this life. First of all, you will enjoy every minute of your life. Second, you will achieve personal growth. That is, your skills will expand, your goals become more and more important to you and to others. And the third outcome is that it's through flow experiences that culture evolves. It is through flow that we can build new forms of art, new technologies, new science, new and better relationship among people. So the evolution of personal abilities, the development of personal skills, is the energy out of which the evolution of culture is made. If there is one legacy that we can leave to the future, knowing that we have contributed something positive to it, it is to live our lives as a constant source of flow.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.